Welcome back to Stacktrace, your weekly podcast about Apple news, rumors, development, technology, and many other things. With me, John Sundell, and my good friend, Mr. Guy Rambo. How's it going, Mr. Rambo?
I am doing really well, John. How are you?
I am doing really well as well. I've had the fun opportunity to go through a lot of articles recently on my website in order to update them for some of the latest APIs for Xcode 13 and so on. And it's been really fun to do that, actually. It sounds like a chore when you say it like that, right? Like, you know, you have to go through your old articles and you're not really getting anything new that you can share with people. It's more like keeping things up to date, which I think is really, really important. But what's been really fun about that exercise is that even though I've made quite a lot of updates, especially to the articles that I've been posting about the latest Swift features that are kind of changing quite a bit during the beta process, especially the new asynchronous system, like this new Swift concurrency system. But in general, I must say that I'm quite surprised as to just how much of the sample code in my articles actually still holds up, even articles that were written in like 2017 or 2018 and so on, like several years ago at this point, because I feel like Swift, you know, developed this reputation very early on that it was always in a state of flux. And it was in the early years, like from Swift 1 to Swift 2 to Swift 3, there was like a lot of breaking changes, but there really hasn't been almost any major big breaking changes. Of course, like details change here and there, but there hasn't been like any huge sweeping changes since like Swift 4. And that's just quite a while ago now. So I feel like Swift should now, we should start to not think of Swift as that anymore, that it's changing so much, because, you know, I have so many articles on my website and most of them, I would say, are still working just as well as the day I wrote them.
Yeah, I think that makes sense, especially given that since Swift 4, it's been source stable, so there are no huge breaking changes to source code. And yeah, I feel like the things that change are just places where you had to write more code before, and now you have to write less code because there are some new syntactic sugar addition or something like that. But that doesn't mean that the old code just doesn't make sense anymore or stops working. I think that's the big difference.
Yeah, absolutely. A good example of that is my article about Swift's result type, which when I wrote that article didn't exist. So that article was initially about how to build your own result type just from scratch and the benefits of using an enum to represent either a successful state or a failed state. But then the standard library did introduce a built-in result type, I believe in Swift 4 or something like that, like along those versions. And then I went back to the article and it's still about mainly about building your own result type, like because I still feel like that part of the article is really valuable, like kind of looking under the hood a little bit or getting a better understanding of the principles behind that result type, even though you will probably use the one that comes built into the standard library. So the update there that I made a few years ago now was all about just incorporating that standard library version of it and then talking about, you know, the differences between maybe your own custom version and the built-in one.
Yeah, and that was a great example of something that every single project had. Like, every single project I've ever done in Swift had its own result type before Swift introduced its own. So I think that was a case where a lot of people were implementing their own, and having this reference as the article is definitely a good resource. And yeah, gotta keep things updated. You don't want someone to be like a person who's newer to Swift to be searching and come across an article that tells them how to implement a result type when they don't have to anymore.
Exactly. And of course, you know, it's almost impossible to keep everything always 100% up to date. And thankfully, I get emails from readers whenever, you know, someone discovers something that isn't up to date that I missed, and they will email me, it seems most of the time, at least, because I do get emails from time to time, and then I can go ahead and fix that, because I do really feel like it's very important to keep things up to date, even though like it's getting harder and harder as the number of articles grow. But again, thankfully, I don't really have to make that many updates on an ongoing basis. It's like a little bit here and there, but I would say most of the code is still relevant, even though I might add something or like we just mentioned, like include a standard library implementation or something like that. But another thing that I find very great or something I'm very pleased with is that the topics themselves also feels very relevant. And I don't mean to say this to like pat myself on the back too much, but you know, I'm really happy that when I go back to an article, even though I feel like I've evolved as a writer since I wrote that article, if it's from a few years ago, and I feel like I can go in and make some kind of cosmetic changes to the text and make it flow better and use some of those new skills I've learned. But overall, like, it's not like the topic has been invalidated, at least not most of the time. There are a few articles that I've deprecated, so to speak, but I would say the vast majority of them still holds up, which I'm very, very proud of and happy about.
And I think we should probably address, you mentioned updating and getting emails and things like that, and I'm sure that someone will probably suggest and has already suggested, well, John, why don't you just, and there's that word again, why don't you just create like a Git repo and people can send pull requests to your articles to fix those things? Why don't you do that, John?
Well, that is a very good question, Rambo. So I would say that the main reason for not doing that is it's not always as simple as just like updating a method call or something like that. Like I just mentioned, it's often involves making some kind of larger structural changes to the article to still be about the same topic, but then include those changes. So it's not typically just like, let me change this method call here or this type name here or something like that because the API changed. It's usually not as simple as that. And while I could definitely enlist the help of the community to do that work, it's something that I feel like I want to do myself because it does involve that kind of writing work and really like changing the article, which I definitely want to do myself anyway. So, you know, getting help from the community and having something be open sourced and having something be that you could make pull requests to is definitely a great tool in many different situations. But it's very important to remember that it's not for free. Like, if you're going to get pull requests, you have to look at them and review them and provide feedback. And this is something that I'm already struggling with a lot as a single person with quite a large number of open source projects. And I sometimes have take a lot of time before I actually give people feedback on their pull requests because I just don't have that time to spend on, you know, pull requests so often. And I feel like the same thing would be true with a repository like this. It's something that would be hard to kind of keep up with, like the communication aspect and things like that, because even though I love working with the community and I love working with other people, like anytime you involve some kind of communication in a project, it always adds some amount of overhead. And it's, a lot of times that overhead is worth it, but in this case, I feel like it's not. I feel like it's better if I am the one who keep my articles up to date and work on them. And then, of course, I welcome feedback. I think almost every single article that I've ever written has in the last paragraph saying something like, if you have any feedback, please email me. And I really mean that. Like, so I get a lot of emails from people, which is great. And I do very often like act on that feedback. So that's how I prefer to run things, at least with Swift by Sundell.
Yeah, that's a really good point. That's where I wanted to get to, because I've had similar things suggested to me in other contexts before. And yeah, that's the case. Like when you have an open source thing, you end up becoming a manager of that thing, whatever it is. And I think in your case, more specifically, your blog in particular is such high profile and has such a big audience that you'd probably be getting like probably multiple pull requests every day, and there's no way you would be able to review all of them in time. And yeah, and sometimes like people send pull requests just to be a part of the project and not really providing a meaningful improvement. Like sometimes it's just a stylistic choice that they have, and then they kind of want to put that in there, but given that it's your blog, you might not want that. So yeah, I think the right course of action in this case is to keep doing what you're doing, which is to receive feedback and basically add that to your to-do list.
Yeah, exactly. Because we have to remember that even though it might just take like 5 or 10 minutes or something to review a pull request, it's a context switch. And depending on the volume, like if you get one pull request a month, then maybe it's not that bad. You can just find some time to make that context switch and review that pull request and then you're done. But to your point, if you get a large amount of them and there's some volume there and you have a lot of other things that you want to work on, like it's always hard to make these decisions like, what do I want to focus on versus what do I not want to focus on? And it's just important to make those decisions, I think, and to focus on the right things for you and what you want to focus on, and just realize that no one can do everything. And this is one of those things where would I like to get the community involved in my kind of writing and in feedback and things like that? Absolutely, that would be great. But it's just very hard for me to envision doing that in a way that I could maintain and that wouldn't be too stressful and so on, right? So I think my current setup works really well. I will mention, though, that when I did originally the published powered version of Swift by Sundell, like when I moved from Squarespace to my own static site generator, I did, I didn't open source the site, but I created a repo where people could provide feedback and start conversations around the new features and what they liked and what they didn't like. And I addressed like vast majority of those issues there. So that's a situation where I would bring in the community and ask for feedback because it was a beta and I really wanted to release it without any regressions and, you know, make things work really well for as many people as I could. And that was a great like way to do that in that case. So I will occasionally like very explicitly ask for feedback and create something like an open source repo to manage that, but it's not something I want like on a kind of daily basis.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Cool. So what about you, Rambo? What have you been up to? Have you been going back to changing your old code, or are you focused on new code?
I've been writing a lot of new codes, which will become old code with time, obviously. And it's funny because when you start a new project, you have all of this new code, and this new app that I've been working on that I haven't really talked about publicly too much yet, but I've been working on it for like a month, a little bit over that maybe, and not like full time, of course. I have other projects, so yeah, a few hours every week. And it's come to the point now where I don't remember how things that I wrote back in the very first days of the project work. Like, I don't really remember anymore. I have to kind of go in there and read the code and read my own documentation to figure out how things work under the hood. So I guess it's starting to get large enough for that to happen.
And I feel that happens especially with side projects or things you do not every day, you know, things you might work on like once a week or twice a week or something. It's just really hard for me to leave something for a few weeks like that and then come back and then, you know, orient myself. Again, speaking about context switching, right? Yeah. It's like then I have released that context from my memory in my brain and now I have to retain it again. And I definitely had that with my CSS project that I'm still working on from time to time. But like every time I jump into that project, because I work on it like once or twice every like month or so, because it's really a side project, then, you know, I really have to reorient myself. So I have to like set aside like a whole day so that I can get into the project again and get productive before it's time to wrap up for the day again.
You mentioned releasing and retaining context. Does that mean that you're an auto-release pool of thoughts or something?
It means that I have not yet been upgraded with ARC, with automatic reference counting. I'm still in the manual memory management phase.
Yeah, and as well as going forward with this project, I've also been busy with some Raspberry Pi stuff. We talked about this before, and we mentioned Raspberry Pi and microcontrollers here and there on this podcast because that's a hobby of mine. Like, I think you mentioned to me that you haven't been really doing a lot of coding in your spare time. And I don't really do any coding in the sense that iOS and Mac developers do coding, but my hobby coding is basically doing like hardware stuff and microcontrollers, which is very different from what we've been doing with Mac and iOS development.
Yeah, absolutely. I think for me, you mentioned there that I haven't done much coding in my spare time lately, and that's definitely true. I think part of that might just be because it's summer here. So, yeah. You know, I'm way more outside and I'm doing gardening and, you know, I've been really getting into pizza baking and these sorts of things, you know, like, I'm kind of doing a lot of other things and I have a lot of other hobbies other than programming and technology and things like that. But I think come winter, I will probably once again, sit down in front of my computer with a big cup of coffee in the winter and do some coding. Yeah. But yeah, I think it's nice to have different kinds of hobbies and to not always be in front of a computer. I think it's healthy to step away and do something else for a while. Even though, you know, it's fun to have hobby projects, and I'm not saying that, you know, no one should have hobby projects. It's great to have that. But I think, you know, depending on what kind of person you are and what you like to do, it can be good to mix things up a little bit from time to time. And it sounds like you've done that with your Raspberry Pi work here. Like you say, it's very different from your normal iOS development. So tell us, what are you doing currently with Raspberry Pi?
Yeah, and it's winter here, so I guess it makes sense that I'm doing coding and then you're doing other stuff like gardening.
Right.
but yeah, like my I have reserved my weekends to be like no computer weekends. I can spend the entire weekend in front of the TV using the Apple TV, but that doesn't count as a computer.
What is a computer?
Yeah, but yeah, I really don't do any coding on weekends. But weeknights and then after I'm done with my main body of work, I do. And also I understand like iOS developers who have a job, who want to have some other type of iOS development in their spare time, because then it's very different from what they do during the day. But in my case, my iOS and Mac side projects are basically my job because I'm an indie developer, so there isn't much I can do in that area. But anyway, so with the Raspberry Pi, I've been playing around with the Raspberry Pi Pico, which is this new board, and it has a microcontroller made by the Raspberry Pi Foundation, so it's the Raspberry Silicon, I guess.
And how's that different from the main Raspberry Pi boards? Because what I know Raspberry Pi for being, and I have, I think, two of them here at home, is for them to be like really tiny, but still full-fledged Linux computers. So how does this kind of microcontroller version, the Pico, differ from the main Raspberry Pi line?
So the main difference is the main Raspberry Pi has, I believe it's a Broadcom SoC, and it has like 1.something gigahertz or maybe even more than that, and has a significant amount of RAM, like 4 gigabytes in some models, Wi-Fi, Bluetooth, and stuff like that. But the Raspberry Pi Pico has the RP2040 microcontroller, so it's not an SoC, it's a microcontroller. So it's more similar to something like an Arduino board than a full-fledged computer. So you're going to be doing more hardware-related and embedded work using this board rather than running Linux on it. I don't think there's any Linux out there that you can run on it. And it's like, it's a microcontroller, so it doesn't have a lot of memory and processing power, but it's a lot for what it is, which is a microcontroller.
Yeah, that sounds really interesting. And what are you using it for? Like, what kind of projects are you working on with this new microcontroller?
So currently I'm learning what you can do with it, how you do things with it, because I'm already familiar with microcontroller stuff and how you communicate with peripherals and things like that, but I'm learning how to do those things in the context of the RP2040, but I don't have like any concrete projects with it so far that I can share with our listeners. But the reason why I'm learning so much about this is because I'm helping my brother with a project of his. So he is an electronics engineer. I think we talked about this before, and he has been doing some online courses on microcontrollers and things like that, and I'm helping him develop a course on the Raspberry Pi Pico. And since it's going to touch on things like Python, because you can program the Pico using MicroPython and CircuitPython, and he is more of a hardware guy and I'm more of a software guy, I'm helping him with the things that software people do better, which is like how to write a little Python script that does something with this board.
Nice. Yeah, that sounds really fun. And I also know that now you can run Swift on Raspberry Pi as well, but I'm not sure if you can run it yet on the Pico. I know that you can run it on the main Raspberry Pi line, but it would be really cool to be able to use Swift also in that context.
That's very interesting. Yeah, I haven't done any research, but I'm pretty sure it would be possible. So, like, this is a very simple processor in the grand scheme of things. It's a dual Cortex M0 with 133 megahertz, and it has like 200 kilobytes of SRAM or something like that. So it's a very, very simple microcontroller, but I think people have been able to run Rust on it, at least experimentally. So I guess it would be able to run Swift as well.
Yeah, because, you know, once Swift gets compiled, then it has a pretty small runtime overhead. And I would guess, like, not really based on any data, but just based on how the languages work, that Python probably has a larger runtime overhead, but perhaps the flavor of Python that you're using here is optimized in certain ways that makes it, you know, particularly well suited for the task of coding for the Pico.
Yeah, I think, yeah, you're right there. And I'm pretty sure there's been at least one project where someone was able to run Swift on the Arduino even, which is even simpler. It's not even an ARM processor. And Swift runs on ARM processors, has been doing that since its inception. So I guess it would be technically even easier to do that. So yeah, it could be a fun project for someone who understands that stuff more than me.
Yeah, absolutely. When it comes to like the low level, like emitting machine code part of the compilation process, I have no clue. Like, nope. this is the part where I wouldn't say that I'm not interested in it. I still find it very fascinating and fun to look into from time to time. But it's really like when it comes to my day-to-day work, it's a part of the tool chain that I don't really look into or have any insight into. My knowledge typically ends when the code goes into the compiler.
Yeah. So yeah, this is a really interesting piece of kit. And if you have a Raspberry Pi computer, like one of the traditional ones, programming for it is super simple. And I even got myself a Raspberry Pi 400, which is this little keyboard, basically, with an embedded Raspberry Pi inside of it. Ooh. And it's actually overclocked a little bit, so you can so it runs a little bit faster than the regular Raspberry Pi. It has two HDMI outputs. You can run two 4K displays with it. Comes with this cute mouse in the colors of the Raspberry Pi. It's a really cute computer. And it runs really well. So I'm running Visual Studio Code on this thing and programming the Pico directly. The Pico has a SWD part, which is for debugging ARM processors. And you can basically, with three wires plus the USB part, you can plug that into your Raspberry Pi 400. And you can build and debug from Visual Studio Code onto the Raspberry Pi Pico, almost as if you were running stuff locally, which is super cool.
That's so amazing. I'm looking at pictures of this Raspberry Pi 400 here, and it looks really cool. And in general, I really love what Raspberry Pi are doing, and I really want to look more into it and start, you know, experimenting with these devices. Like I said, I have a few of them here, but they're some of the older models. But still, like, the hardware fascinates me, and also, like, the whole kind of company and what they're doing to kind of democratize hardware, and also like providing a venue for people to get into coding and work with hardware like you're doing as well, I think it's just really, really cool. So yeah, I find it's all really fascinating, even though I haven't really had time yet to fully dive into this ecosystem.
Yeah, the whole Raspberry Pi ecosystem is a lot of fun, and everything is very well documented. And there's a huge community of people who are willing to help beginners and even people who are more experienced. So this feels like the hobby computing scene that we hear about from like the beginnings of Apple and other computer companies. It feels a bit like going back to that sort of experience where you get a computer, but it's more like a kit, and you do whatever you want with it. So yeah, it is a lot of fun.
Yeah, absolutely. And what's the debugging experience like? You mentioned that you're able to like connect a few ports and start debugging things like that, even if it's running on the Pico board. But what's the overall kind of debugging experience like when you have some piece of code and you want to try it out? How does that all work?
After you get everything set up, which is a bit involved, but there are instructions on the manual and things like that. Once you get everything set up and running, you basically configure your Visual Studio Code project. And you don't have to use Visual Studio Code, but I like to use it because I'm used to it. You basically have a little play button in Visual Studio Code, just like in Xcode. And you press play and it will compile your project, flash it into the Pico and start running. And any breakpoints that you've set by clicking the line number, just like you do in Xcode, are going to get triggered. And you can run GDB commands. It's using GDB under the hood. And that's it. Like, it's pretty much like running something on your iPhone from Xcode.
Very cool. Yeah, you're getting me really excited now. Maybe I will order some of these things and try it out. It sounds like a lot of fun.
And with the CircuitPython and MicroPython stuff, so these are basically two separate projects that let you run Python on the board. So you first flash the interpreter, and once you do that, the board then becomes this Python board. And when you plug it into the computer, and that can be your Raspberry Pi or it can be a Mac even. I've done stuff on the Mac as well. It basically communicates over USB, which is emulating a serial port. And you can even access the repo, the Python repo on the board. So you can basically run Python directly using the repo on the board, and you can test your code that way, and then you can like copy the code from the repo and paste it onto your script and run it permanently. So that's also super cool.
Very cool. It's like a little hardware playground, right?
Yeah, definitely.
Awesome. So speaking of new small hardware that is fun, we are going to talk about Playdate. And you have had some early access to the Playdate SDK, which I'm really excited to hear about some of your experiences with that. But before we jump into that, let's take a very quick break to thank this episode's first sponsor. This week's episode of Stacktrace is brought to you by Bitrise, my favorite way to do continuous integration and delivery for iOS apps and other Swift projects. Using it, you can build, test, and ship your app in the cloud completely automatically. I've personally been a Bitrise user for many years now. I use it for client projects, both big and small, for my open source tools, and more. And the reason that I've kept using it for so long and plan to keep using it for many years to come is because it's fast, it's rock solid, and it's always up to date. Head over to bitrise.io/swift, sign in with either your GitHub, GitLab, or Bitbucket account, select what project that you want to build, and that's it. I know that sounds too good to be true, but for so many apps, Bitrise can automatically configure a great set of build settings for your project without you having to do anything. It can detect what dependencies that you have and how you manage them, what sort of testing bundles that you have, and what targets that your Xcode project contains. But that just scratches the surface of just how powerful Bitrise is. You can customize almost any aspect of your build pipeline, including what version of macOS and Xcode that you want to use, and they always support the very latest versions and Xcode betas, by the way. You can run any kind of command line tool or script that you want. You can add powerful add-ons that do things like automatic deployment, test result visualization, and crash reporting. And now, Bitrise have also launched Gen 2, the second generation of their build infrastructure, which offers up to 50% faster builds. So if you haven't yet experienced just how nice it is to have every commit, every pull request, and every release automatically built, tested, and distributed in the cloud, or if you're currently using some other more complex way to do continuous integration, then I really recommend heading over to bitrise.io/swift to see just how fast, stable, and easy to use Bitrise is. There's no credit card required, and their free tier is super generous. Once again, that's bitrice.io/swift to set up the same kind of continuous integration and delivery that I and thousands of other developers around the world use for our projects. Thanks a lot to Bitrice for sponsoring this week's episode of Stacktrace. All right, Rambo, so let's talk about the Playdate, Panic's new handheld gaming system, which went on pre-order sale last week as we record, so a few days ago. And there's a lot of hype about it. It seems really, really exciting and fun. Can you tell us a little bit about the hardware and then also talk about what your initial experience using their SDK has been like?
Sure. So for those of you who don't know, I guess most listeners of this podcast will know, but the Playdate is this little gaming console, a portable gaming console, and it has a crank, which is kind of interesting. It has a D-pad and then two buttons, and it runs games and has a 1-bit screen, basically. So you get either black or white. There are no shades of gray. It's been in development for a really long time. I think it was first talked about publicly back in 2019. And last Thursday, they finally went up for pre-order. And I was one of the happy customers who was able to get one of the first batch orders. So I should be getting my hardware by the end of this year, hopefully. And also, I am in the developer program for Playdate because, of course, I am. Like, yeah.
Rambo the game developer.
Definitely. So the thing about the Playdate is a lot of what we mentioned about the Raspberry Pi ecosystem can be said about the Playdate. And people who know Panic, the company behind Playdate and their apps, will know like this Panic way of doing things. Like, they have a very fun culture, at least in my opinion, and they do things in a nice way and in a fun way, and they seem to be really obsessed with quality, and their stuff is usually really high quality. You can see that in their apps, and you can also see that on the Playdate, even though I don't have the hardware here, but people who have reviewed the hardware have mentioned that it's really high quality. So my interest in the development story for Playdate is first of all, because this is a fully hackable device, and that means that unlike some other consoles, like if I want to write a game for the Nintendo Switch, I have to like join this super secret developer program by Nintendo and probably pay them a lot of money. And they have to like approve my game idea. And yeah, there's a lot of steps in there. And probably me as an indie developer who doesn't even have like a concrete game idea yet, would never be able to get into that. But with the Playdate, every device is a developer unit, basically. You can just flash your game on the device and play it, and people can also download your game and play it. There's no like app store that you need to be approved to be on or anything like that.
Yeah, that aspect I think is really awesome. Just like you said, a lot of things that we said about the Raspberry Pi can also be said about this. The fact that you have this open platform is really, really inspiring, and that you can just plug it in and develop for it and distribute your games. You can have other people download your games and install them on their Playdate. Like, that I find very, very exciting. Just to comment very quickly on what you said there about other games consoles, and that's definitely true that for a lot of game consoles, you need to be part of a developer program that is a little bit more formal than signing up for something like the Apple Developer Program or Google Developer Program or something like that. And you typically also have to have some kind of development kit in order to develop for that console. And initially, that might seem to be just to kind of limit the amount of people that can work on this thing or something like that. But there has some technical reasons. Not maybe for every single platform, but for a lot of game consoles, if you want to develop for it, having all the developer tools and everything like that running on the console takes up a certain amount of RAM and CPU and things like that, of course, like things like a debugger and just a connection to the computer and things like that. And games for consoles are typically written in a way where they will try to squeeze out every little piece of RAM and CPU there is, and they will be very fine-tuned for that specific console. That's why you can see games running on a game console sometimes have comparable graphics to running on a high-end gaming PC. That's not always true, of course, but you know, many times a console will really perform very well, if especially if you just look at the specs and compare them to something like a PC, it will work really well. And that's the reason, like technically, why so many consoles have specific dev kits, because these dev kits come with more RAM and they come with like a larger hardware budget so that you can use all the development tools and still run your game in a way that feels and plays like on a real console. But then, of course, you have also the kind of politics around it, or you know, the process around it, which I think a lot of that is also inherited from a time when games weren't distributed like over the air. You could patch things whenever you wanted to. There's things like certification and things like that involved when, you know, they would print games on cartridges or discs, and it was very, very important that the game would be bug free. So, you know, there's a lot of process involved for that as well. So I think all of these things have reason, even though it can be frustrating coming from a more open ecosystem. It's funny that we say open ecosystem being Apple developers, but here we are. But the Playdate has none of that legacy, right? It has none of that at all. You can just use it, and I don't think you even need to sign up for some developer program later once it has been launched. I think, you know, it's only now when it's currently in beta. So it's really, really cool to see.
Yeah, just to make this clear, right now, access to their SDK is limited because it's basically a beta, a closed beta process where they're collecting feedback and things like that. And even because of that, there are some things that I'm not even allowed to talk about, and I'm not going to talk about any of them. But they are basically asking developers to start playing around with it and give them feedback. This has been going on for quite a while, and I can see, like, given the quality that I'm seeing in their documentation and things like that, you can see that a lot of work has been put into making this a really good developer experience. And once this is out for everyone, everyone will be able to get access to it. But you could see how some other company, even like the context here is Panic, a company that hasn't done game consoles or any hardware for that matter in the past, is doing a game console for the first time. You could see how other companies might impose those artificial limitations, like, oh, all code has to be signed, and in order to sign it, you need to join the developer program and pay a fee, and you can only install things from within this app store, within the console. Yeah, you could totally see some other company doing it like that. And Panic is basically...
Which platform does that remind me
yeah.
of?
I mean, every gaming console and Apple's devices.
Exactly, yeah. And it's funny because at Panic, they're mostly, up until this point, writing software for Apple platforms, right? So, my initial, without knowing anything about this development program, when I started looking into it, was they would probably adopt some similar philosophy or setup as Apple has, because that's what they're used to as developers. But no, they're making this like super open thing, which I find it very, very nice. And I'm very happy they went this route.
Yeah. So I really like that approach. And I'm curious to see what this looks like once the hardware is on people's hands. So you'll have like the first season of games, which you get for free with the hardware. They haven't really said much about what happens later, like when is season 2 coming out, we'll have to pay like a subscription to get all of the seasons or something like that. They haven't really disclosed how that's going to work, but it's a really interesting model where you get the gaming console, and then I think it's every week you get two games just show up on the device. I think that's a really interesting and different model for a gaming console.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's a super interesting thing about this. And, you know, it reminds me a little bit of Game Pass, which I am a huge fan of. Like, you know, ever since I got my Xbox, I've been playing mostly games from Game Pass, and there's also games added to it all the time. And of course, it's not the same model because it's a subscription service on top of your hardware purchase. Here, everything is kind of connected together. But it's the same general idea, is that, you know, you get new games dropped like every N amount of time. And that is just really nice, because what that ends up leading to, at least for me and for a lot of other people, is you try different games that you otherwise wouldn't have tried because you would never have bought them if you had to pay money for a specific game, right? So I end up trying like all sorts of different games that really just expand my taste. And some of them I find really, really good. And I'm just very happy that I have that opportunity. So I think this is going to be a very cool aspect for the playdate as well.
Yeah, definitely.
So let's talk a bit about the SDK. And I know you said you can't reveal any like details and things like that. You've signed the Panic NDA and so on. Not the Friend DA, the Panic NDA. But one thing that they have made public is that it's using a combination of the Lua programming language for high-level logic and for scripting. And then you can drop down to C and things like that for more low-level performance. And they also are going to release a browser-based game creation tool called Pulp, which you can just write games without any coding at all. So in a very visual kind of what you see is what you get type of way. So what do you think about this tech stack in general? Like the fact that there are these different levels, and what's your kind of initial impression? I know you haven't tried Pulp yet, but what's your initial impression of the Lua and C part of it?
Yeah, I really like it. I think Lua makes sense. It's very common in game development. So many game developers are already used to Lua. It's a bit weird to me because I'm not used to Lua. So it has some interesting design decisions like indexes start at 1 and not 0, and 0 evaluates to true and not false. So
it's like you're living in the mirror universe where everything is the opposite of what you're used to.
Yeah, so there are some things that are weird for people who are not used to Lua. And of course, that has nothing to do with the Playdate SDK itself. It's a language thing. But they probably made the right decision to use Lua. It's probably free to use as well. Like they didn't need to like license the language or something like that. And it's probably lightweight. And I think it's also one of those interpreted languages that can also be compiled, right? Mm-hmm. So they can get performance and probably also size benefits from compiling the Lua code for the playdate. But they also make available C level APIs. So if you need to like squeeze out the most performance that you can, and or if you need like a particular subroutine of your game to be extremely high performance, you have some algorithm that you want to run, you can drop down to C and expose that to your Lua code. So they've addressed both cases there, but they strongly recommend sticking with Lua until you notice that you're in need of more performance.
Yeah, and that makes sense. And yeah, in the context of the game world, this is a very, very common setup that you have a game engine that is written in a more low-level language, and you can then extend that and write your own code and so on, which is very similar to here with the C-based API. And then you have some kind of scripting environment where you write most of the kind of game logic and the kind of scenarios and the story and the quests and so on. They are all kind of scripted on top of the more performant game engine. Because when you're iterating, especially if you're working on a larger kind of AAA game, which can take like a long, long time to compile the code for, you know, something like a blockbuster game like The Last of Us or something, I'm sure they don't just hit like Command R in their development environment and have the game up and running in a second, right? Like it takes a long time to make compile that kind of code. So that's why, you know, a lot of these game studios use a scripting environment for like most of the kind of higher level logic. And, you know, this is a architecture is also being used here, which I think makes total sense. And I don't have a lot of experience with Lua, but it seems like a very interesting, fun little language that is, like you said, very common for this kind of game scripting and game prototyping and things like that.
Yeah, definitely. And also there's an interesting background to the Lua language that it's Brazilian. So it was made in Brazil.
Very cool. And the hardware company that Panic are partnering with, Teenage Engineering, is a Swedish company. So there's both some of Brazil and some of Sweden in this product.
yeah, really nice. The SDK is well documented, and I've been playing around with it. My ideas in terms of what I want to actually do with it are mostly fun, quirky little apps and not really games, but I might have some idea for some game at some point. But what really caught my attention with this device is just how limited it is and how those constraints can lead to some creative solutions. I think we mentioned many times before how we like to sometimes work in a constrained environment, because that usually results in interesting results when you have to be creative to overcome those limitations. So this device is not like a super fast Apple Silicon Mac with 5 terabytes of RAM or something. It's a very small computer with a very small processor with not much RAM and not much processing power, and a screen that only has 2 colors, black or not black, basically. And I think that's an interesting environment to create in.
Yeah, absolutely. I really love the idea of this, and I'm also hoping to develop something for this in the future at some point. And I think, Rambo, you know, you have a great opportunity here, because we've talked about that so many of your app icons, they look a little bit like game characters. So I think you should definitely be making an Air Buddy game crossover on the playdate where you can play as an Air Buddy.
Yeah, I was actually kind of thinking about making Air Buddy for the playdates as a joke. So I might do that.
Watch out on the 1st of April in 2022.
Oh, I should probably note that in my calendar here.
Yeah, for sure. All right, so I'm sure we'll have more updates on the playdate as we get our hands on the hardware and as we get to start exploring, developing for it and so on in the future. It might take a while before we get our units, both of us, but, you know, we have to be patient. But now let's talk about another piece of hardware that was announced recently, which is an announcement from Google. Google, they have announced that they are also joining Apple and many other companies in the System on a Chip game, SoC, that they are developing a new Tensor SoC that is going to be used in their upcoming line of Pixel phones. So Google developing their own silicon, Rambo. I mean, they have been doing it in the past for things like data centers. They have their TPUs that are running for machine learning in data centers and so on. But this is the first time, I think, that they are doing a SoC for a consumer product like a phone. So what do you think about this news?
Yeah, I think it's fascinating. And I think this shows the direction that the industry is moving towards. And this trend has been developing for a while now, where companies are starting to reach, I guess, the limits of what's possible with off-the-shelf hardware and software made for the hardware, and moving more and more stuff into specialized hardware, which is what Apple has been doing for a really long time. Of course, they have their SoC, which is what runs the general purpose software, but they also have a bunch of purpose-made processors for other things.
Yeah, exactly. I think there are two main factors driving this trend, and I think we're going to see this a lot more in our industry, like a lot more purpose-built hardware for specific products and for specific tasks. And I think the first reason is kind of the quote-unquote end of Moore's law, right? That yeah. CPU power is not increasing as it used to at the same rate, which means that, you know, you have to invent other solutions to get more performance on a kind of year by year by year basis. And SoCs is a way to do that, which leads us to reason number two, which is that a lot of tasks that are performed these days in products and in applications is getting more and more kind of domain specific. And, you know, the two main kind of examples of that today are graphics, which is done by a GPU, and now machine learning is getting increasingly offloaded to specialized hardware like the neural engine on Apple's platforms and Apple Silicon. And I think this is just a trend we're going to see keep increasing. And we also have the Secure Enclave, of course, for things like security. And I wouldn't be surprised if we see more and more of specialized hardware being invented and added to these systems on a chip to perform increasingly specialized tasks that can be kind of really fast-tracked in hardware.
Yeah, and this also includes a chip made by Google specifically for security, so kind of like the Secure Enclave. So, yeah, very similar to what we've seen Apple do in recent years.
Yeah, exactly. This does raise some interesting questions, though, around the development environments, because if we take the GPU as an example, that's something that has historically always been coded for using specific tools like shaders and things like that, that are different languages than what you use to program the CPU. And the neural engine, you are using like models that are evaluated on the neural engine. You're not really coding anything specifically that's running directly on the neural engine. You're more like writing certain tasks and calling certain APIs that the system then offloads onto the neural engine. So it's interesting to think about what this shift towards more specialized hardware and these types of SoCs might mean for us as developers. Like, will we need to learn at some point different programming languages for different parts of SoCs? Or do we think that it's going to become more like Swift, for example, on Apple's platform, that we could use Swift even to program the GPU or to write code directly against the neural engine or something like that? What do you think?
I think this is where we have to apply developer tools because you can't expect developers to be like writing code specifically for the whatever engine or the whatever security chip or something like that. You need to have those things baked into your development environment in such a way where they are completely abstracted away from whatever the developer is doing. And I think that's where Apple has a big advantage over other vendors, because they control all of the stack and they introduced features in both their developer tools and languages and runtime that we as developers have been using for a long time, and we had been using them for quite a while before they were put to use, like dispatch queues and the whole dispatch system and other features like that, where we started using them for particular reasons and the whole system started having its APIs built around them. And then when Apple introduced a new silicon or something else with more cores or the ability to run more threads, you basically get advantages for free just because you're using the APIs that have been made available in the development environment. So I'm not sure what the story is going to be for this particular processor, given that the Android market is more fragmented. And I don't think it's safe to expect that a given Android app is going to have optimizations made specifically for the Google SoC. I don't think that's something that we should expect.
Yeah, it could probably be something where they are hardware accelerating certain API calls kind of under the hood, right? Where, you know, to your point, that has been something Apple have been doing for a long time with, you know, things like, you know, different frameworks, like, you know, you're using some image processing frameworks or some video encoding APIs and things like that, that does get hardware accelerated, but it's not really something you're aware of or you have to be aware of as a developer. But the GPU counterexample is interesting because, like I mentioned, with GPUs, we are coding directly against them. I mean, not directly, but we're writing specific shaders and things like that for GPUs. And that's an interesting counterpoint, because GPUs are performing a very specific task, and it wouldn't really make a lot of sense to have a super general purpose programming language available for that, because the GPU couldn't really execute all of those instructions that you could write using that language. So using something more domain specific there makes sense. But at the same time, to your point, like, the development experience is really important. So I feel like it's a little bit of a balance that needs to be struck between specialized hardware and not too specialized developer tools.
Yeah, it's the old thing. Like, it doesn't matter if there's this super amazing chip inside your device if no code that's running on that device is taking any advantage of that chip. And I think that's where the companies have to work on making it so you developers don't have to take advantage of that chip. The system is going to do that for them. And I think Apple has been successful in doing that in a way that no other hardware company has so far.
Yeah, exactly. And Apple does have the advantage here that it's one ecosystem, while to your point, Android is more fragmented. So it's going to be interesting to see. I'm sure Google are going to do a lot of work similar to what Apple has been doing with things like Rosetta, right? Mm-hmm. You know, we're not talking about different architectures here, because this is an ARM chip, as far as I know, and Android also runs to a large extent on ARM as well. So, you know, I don't think that's the case here, that they need to do some kind of emulation, but they probably have to do a lot of automation and things like that to enable really fast execution, even though the vast majority of apps might not be written specifically for the Pixel phones.
Yeah, and they shouldn't be, right? Because that's not how the Android market works, where you make an app just for the Pixel. You have to make it available for as many devices as possible. So, yeah, it's a challenge.
Yeah, for sure. Really looking forward to see what will happen here. And it's fun to see Google taking up this SoC endeavor and how that will compare to Apple Silicon. And, you know, more competition is always better. So let's see what's going to happen here.
Absolutely.
But now let's jump into our final topic for this episode, which is, of course, our Ask Stacktrace segment. But before we do, let's take another quick break to thank this episode's second and final sponsor. This week's episode of Stacktrace is also brought to you by our friends at Pillow, the app that can help you become more aware of your sleep patterns and ultimately help you improve your sleep quality. Go to pillow.app to learn more and to download the app completely for free. Using Pillow is super simple. If you have an Apple Watch, then all that you have to do is to wear your Apple Watch while you sleep, and Pillow will automatically track and analyze your sleep and will give you a full report when you wake up in the morning. But if you want to use Pillow with just your iPhone or iPad, then you can do that too. Just press a single button in the app when you're going to sleep, and that's it. But if you do have an Apple Watch, then you can also get important information about your heart rate, including trends, variability, any heart rate dips that might occur, blood oxygen levels, and more for each sleep session. You can even have Pillow automatically record sounds like sleep talking or sleep apnea, snoring, and other noises that might be affecting your sleep, and a lot of users have been quite surprised by the results. Another valuable aspect of Pillow is that it can help you make more informed decisions on how to improve your sleep. Pillow comes with a dedicated section where you can discover trends, get personalized insights, sleep tips, and easily compare your sleep metrics with things like your weight, steps you've taken, caffeine consumption, and other health metrics. Pillow also comes with an expanding collection of sleep aid sounds, guided meditations, bedtime stories, and music that was specifically produced for sleeping. But last but not least, Pillow is also very privacy-minded. All of your sleep and audio data is fully encrypted and stored on your device and in your iCloud storage account using end-to-end encryption. You don't need to register or create an account to use Pillow. You can use it completely anonymously, and it doesn't collect or send your personal data anywhere else. Pillow is free to download from the App Store, and it comes with a great set of features that you can use every night. Just visit pillow.app to get started. Once again, that's pillow.app to check out Pillow. Thanks a lot to Pillow for sponsoring this week's episode of Stacktrace. All right, Rambo, so it's time for an Ask Stacktrace question. And our question this week comes from Casey. And Casey asks, do you ever push back against what a designer may ask for in their design spec? Do you have any tips on how to go about that? Because Casey says that, I find sometimes that designers will ask for things that are really complicated to implement and probably won't do much for users. For example, certain instances of custom animations. So Rambo, have you ever been in a situation like this where you've been asked to implement something by a designer and you felt like this wasn't the right thing to do and you had to kind of quote-unquote push back on that? And do you have any tips for Casey here?
Don't cut out the animations. Come on. Yes, this is a very interesting designer-developer relationship kind of question that shows up a lot. And this will highly depend on your environment. So I'm assuming that you work on a semi-regular iOS development team where you have at least a designer, at least one developer, but you also have at least one product person that can be like a product manager or someone with that role. So in this case, I think it's really important to learn how important do the people who designed the product, and I'm saying design in terms of product design, not in terms of visual design. So how important are those things that you think are going to be too complicated to implement to the product? So ask the product manager, could we maybe leave this custom animation out, at least for now, so that we can ship sooner? And you can also negotiate, like, oh, if I have to do this, it's going to take me 5 days, but if we skip this or if we change this little thing, I can do it in 1 day. I think most product managers would prefer the 1 day version. There are other cases, like this case would be like a thing that goes beyond what like the minimum viable product, so the custom animation or something like that. But sometimes you come across places where the design is just wrong, like it's not following the design guidelines, the human interface guidelines from Apple in the case of iOS, or they do something in a way that doesn't feel native to the system. And in those cases, it's a case of presenting the designer with the issue and explaining it to them and showing them the human interface guidelines and why that's the case. And they might come back with an argument and explain why they did it in a different way. And that might make sense. So I think this is a case where you really have to have your communication skills really sharp in order to communicate with the designer and possibly also with a product manager on what should we focus on right now. But I think most cases where I've seen this happen, where a developer is really pushing back on things like this, it was mostly a case of this is going to take way longer than doing it the simpler route. And what's usually happened in those cases is we went with the simpler route to begin with, and then the extra stuff that would take longer was just added in later. And I think that's a good compromise.
Yeah, absolutely. Just how it's usually a good idea to find an iterative way to implement a code change. For example, if you want to refactor your code or change to a new architecture, and this is something we've talked about many times on this podcast, and that we're both really big fans of an iterative approach there, right? Like, don't rewrite your app from scratch.
Yep.
See if you can iterate to that new implementation. And I think the same thing can definitely be said for design as well. If you can find a way to implement a complex design in an iterative way, which might involve shipping that initial version or a couple of different versions before you end up in that end state where you want to be, that can be really, really great. So I definitely agree with you that this is definitely mostly a communications problem, not really a technical problem. It's mostly about how you communicate with the designers on your team and other developers and how you really get on the same page and how you feel like you're all working on the same project, not that you're working on two really distinct parts of a project. Because so often when I see this happening in the teams that I work with, when there's some kind of pushback between the design and the development team, is that they are not really working that much together. Like the designer, they go off and they design something and then they come with a spec, right? Like a PNG or something and say, here's the spec, now go and build it. And then the developers look at that and they say, well, this is too complicated. You have to go back and redesign this. And this is not really a collaborative process like what I'm describing here. This is a really like a back and forth. It's usually not that productive. It can lead to a lot of conflict and it can be really awkward like to work in that situation. So what I usually try to work with the teams that I you know, collaborate with is to establish a more kind of collaborative environment in this particular case where, for example, if you can get the designers to be get the developers more involved earlier in the process and to get feedback from them early, that can lead to tweaks being made to the design that makes the development easier and still fulfills the goals of the design earlier on. So it's not like a thing where they are finished from their point of view, like they're done, they're moving on to new tasks, and then they get this quote-unquote pushback and they have to go back and redesign things basically, which again, it's a kind of awkward situation. So getting developer and designer feedback, like getting that collaboration going early in each process of each project, I think is really, really important. And also to kind of, I like to call it living in each other's worlds, which means that rather than having a spec be like a deliverable, to perhaps do a more organic thing where perhaps you as a developer, you jump into the sketch file or the Figma file and you take a look at what's going on there and you work with your designer and you perhaps like you know, get more familiar with their process as well, which can help you understand some of those decisions and that context. And then you can, again, provide that feedback earlier so that you can, like, inform your designers about things like the human interface guidelines or, like, iOS-specific patterns and things that they might not be super familiar with, depending on what kind of designer they are and what they're focusing on. So I think, like, having that collaborative process is really, really key. But when you do need to push back, like when you're in that situation, I definitely agree with you there, Rambo, that presenting alternatives is really important. Like, don't just say that this is too complicated to implement. That's not very constructive. Instead, give a couple of options. Like, we can do it this way. We can do it A, B, or C. Like, A, zero animations. B, some simple animations. C, the very complex animations. And then let the team decide, right? Like, what do we want to go for here? And again, the estimates here are really important. Like, okay, this is going to take 5 minutes, this is going to take 5 hours, and this is going to take 5 days. And you mentioned there also that the product manager will usually very often go for the simplest approach. And that might be true, but I also think it's very important to not always go for the simplest approach, because then you could end up with a really boring product. So I think you also mentioned it earlier, said that how important is the design to the product? And that is so important, because you don't want to be in a situation where you're always taking the simplest route and then you end up with a product that has zero personality. So it's a balance you have to strike on an ongoing basis, but I really think it needs to be something collaborative. It can't just be a developer deciding that this is too complicated, the designer has to go and redesign, and it also can't be just a designer designing things without any kind of thought about how hard something will be to build. It needs to be that continuous feedback between the two.
Yeah, and also, like, don't let the, like, a culture of laziness fester in your company on the development side. Like, I have seen this happen in the past, where basically there's a culture where the developers are always going to push back on anything that means that they have to do any work. And, like, if you're like that, then just quit. Like, that's your job as the developer to do things, and you're gonna have challenges thrown your way. So don't feel like you are entitled to push back on anything that's slightly harder than just using a default UI button. So you have to also keep that in mind, and that's why I mentioned it always has to be a negotiation. So the parties involved should negotiate, like, how important is this for the product that we're making, and how important is this that we get this there now rather than in the next update instead. So everyone has to be on the same page regarding that.
Absolutely. And also embrace the challenge, right? As a developer, if you get something from a designer that looks really complicated, again, it might be the right decision, it might not be, but if it turns out to be, then embrace that and be like, great, I can learn now something new, maybe I get to use some different tool, maybe I get to write, like, a custom animation curve or something like that, maybe you haven't done that before. It can sometimes seem really complicated, but you might learn something and evolve also as a developer, which is really great. And also, speaking about that collaboration that I talked about earlier, perhaps something looks really complicated if you get something like a spec or like a PNG or a video or something like an animation. But then when you talk to the designer and you look into how they actually built this themselves, like the prototype or the design, once you get the parameters and understand the logic behind that animation or something, that could also make it so that it's actually not as complicated as first might have seemed like. And if you can then bring that to life, then your app might look fantastic. Your designer is super happy because they got this really cool design implemented in the end product. And you as the developer can be really proud of this cool thing you built. So, you know, if all works out like that, it can be a really positive experience for the team as well. So, you know, I don't think we're saying here that you should always go the simplest route. Definitely not. It can be really, really nice to work as a team on a sophisticated UI that you bring to life.
Yeah, and I also want to address another scenario where sometimes, depending on how you're working, maybe you're working as a freelancer, but regardless of your working arrangement, sometimes the characters involved in this story could be just a designer, a developer, and the quote, boss, so the person who's paying for stuff. And in that case, it might be a little bit more tricky because you might have the boss telling you, oh, we need this shipped by Friday, while the designer is handing you this super complicated, convoluted design with 100% custom controls and animations and things like that. And in that case, then you need to tell the boss that, hey, your budget won't allow for this to become a reality, basically. And the budget here can be time budget or money budget, whatever. It can be any one of them. So that's an alternate scenario here.
Yeah, and that's a scenario that I personally find myself in all the time as a freelancer.
Yeah.
Like, I get some really cool designs or just like ideas for product features from the team, and it seems really cool. We all are excited about it, but then we look into the deadlines and the budget and so on, and perhaps it doesn't seem realistic to build this thing. And again, this is a communication problem. You have to communicate about that. Like, don't feel like you just have to build it just because someone came up with it. It can be a dialogue, and these constraints, something that people might not be aware of. And as a freelancer, it sometimes becomes really funny where, you know, sometimes someone will come to me and say, hey, can you build this button? And I will say, yeah, sure, that's going to take 1 hour. And I build it in 1 hour and deliver it. And then they ask me something very similar, like, but what about this list? And I'm like, okay, that's going to take 5 days. And they, for them, like, that seems very contradictory because it's just pixels on the screen. But as we know as developers, the logic behind the pixels can sometimes vary a lot in complexity. So it's also really important to inform people of this on an ongoing basis. And again, to provide that feedback as early as possible, both to your client, if you're working as a freelancer, to your designer, to your team, to not just say that this is too complicated, but to explain why. And, you know, to also practice articulating and explaining the technical details of something to someone who is not a programmer. That is also really important, I feel like.
Definitely.
Great. So hope you enjoyed this answer, Casey, and that we gave you some good tips for your situation. And also to all of our other listeners, hope you also enjoyed this Ask Stacktrace segment. I want to once again put out a call for questions here. So please send us any questions that you have about us, about our work, about programming, about anything else in the technology world. Feel free to ask us any question, AMA, as the kids say. Just tweet with a hashtag Ask Stacktrace or email us at stacktrace@9to5mac.com. You can just use your first name. We don't have to reveal exactly who you are. That's fine. We just want some questions from our wonderful listeners. So please send us questions. But we've now reached the end of this episode of Stacktrace. So all that remains is for us to thank our two wonderful sponsors for this episode, which were Pillow and Bitrise. Feel free to check out either of those two sponsors to help support our podcast. But regardless, thanks a lot for listening. And we will talk to you again next week. So say goodbye, Mr. Rambo.
Goodbye.